Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks so much for being here with us today, everybody. And you need to be here with us today because we're going to have an important conversation. Important conversations aren't always interesting because important conversations can be about mathematical figures and symbols that you don't always understand if you didn't go much past the early middle school math. And those can be important to folks who did. But today's important conversation is about gun control, gun violence, gun issues. And our guest today is with Miss Lori Haas. Good morning, Lori.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking the time and the trouble to come visit us from Richmond.
Yes. Thank you very much for having me. It's an important conversation.
Lori is the Virginia State Director for the Education Fund to Stop Gun Violence, and also the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Those two organizations are two separate ones. One is, and I never get these numbers right, 501(c). That's a nonprofit.
That's correct.
The other is a 501(c).
And that is also a nonprofit.
What's the difference?
C3s, it's a frankly not too much difference in certain areas, but in other areas it is quite different. C3s can accept tax donations to C3s are tax deductible. Donations to C4s are not. C3s do a lot of policy and programmatic work, and C4s will do often do some messaging and advocacy work. So they're sister organizations. We're essentially one large package, but it allows us to work on the issue from a public health perspective, but also from a advocacy perspective as well.
And I don't want to get too far away from the conversation about guns and gun violence, but from people who might be sort of in the middle or on the other side, why do these two organizations need to be separate?
They don't. There are many organizations not in the nonprofit world that set up like that. Many, many organizations have a C3 and a C4 so that they can accommodate their membership, they can accommodate donations, they can accommodate a variety of types of work in the nonprofit space. It's not unusual at all.
Well, let's focus on the conversation and the topic. Again, Lori Haas, a Virginia State Director for the Education Fund to Stop Gun Violence and the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, coming up from Richmond today. So let me share folks about your story. After your daughter Emily was shot twice and survived the 2007 Virginia Tech massacre, Ms. Haas became personally involved in gun violence prevention efforts. She's worked with the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, the Virginia Senate, the Virginia Center for Public Safety, Protect Easy Guns and Mayors Against Illegal Guns. She's lobbied on Capitol Hill in Washington and before the General Assembly for responsible gun laws numerous times. Lori promotes awareness of the issue by speaking to various groups from her perspective as a family member of someone who has survived gun violence. 12 years.
Almost.
And I'm sure that's every day.
Yes.
Yes. We'll get into that a little bit later because just right now, on a daily basis, you've been working with the Virginia General Assembly.
Yes.
So let's talk about that. What's been going on in the legislature?
Mm-hmm. You know, as we've seen or I've seen over these many years since I've been doing this work, is a real commitment by some in the legislature to save lives and to promote policies, legislative efforts that would put policies in place that can limit access to firearms by person at risk, and people at risk for a variety of reasons. They might be subject to a protective order. They might be have a misdemeanor, a violent misdemeanor conviction against them. They might show signs of crisis and be at risk of self-harm or harm to others. There is no single solution, you know, to preventing gun violence. It occurs in many places and spaces. We saw legislation to require persons whose firearms are lost or stolen to report that to law enforcement. This can help dry up the unregulated market that so often puts too many firearms into impacted communities. We see disparaging, you know, a large amount of gun violence in some communities, you know, and we need to do something about that. So it's a wide variety of pieces of legislation we've seen over the years, you know, course background checks and, you know, prohibiting firearms on K through 12 grounds. We've stopped firearms bills that would have allowed campus carry. So it's a number of issues, a number of policies. Sadly, we can't get good legislation passed. We have been able to move the ball a little bit and stop some of the bad legislation from going forward. I used to have to ask the governor for a number of vetoes because a number of bad bills would get out. And in 2018, no bad bills got out. We didn't have to ask the governor for any vetoes, so we consider that moving the ball. In 2019, we do have one bill that we'll be asking for a veto on.
And what's that?
It was a bill that would create a new class of law enforcement officer, part-time law enforcement officers who would be called school protection officers. And while we wholly support making our schools safer, adding a new category of law enforcement officer, and which would require the DCJS to come up with new training guidelines and new modules and just an entirely new class of officer, just doesn't make practical sense. And it really doesn't do the kinds of things that we think need to be done to protect our children.
Do you think that's in relation to the Stoneman Douglas
accident certainly.
From last year?
Oh, certainly. You know, there's been a big response after a school shooting of that magnitude, and that has had such a broad spotlight, you know, shown on that tragedy. The fact is, our children are safer in schools than anywhere else in their life.
There have been other school shooting incidents that didn't bring about that bill.
That's correct. That's the point. School children are very safe in their school classrooms. They're very safe in their school environments. There are other environments when they're not as safe. I mean, it's a greater risk for school children to have accidents, you know, in the home or in a car or traveling or in a playground or other places and spaces. So I was at a meeting with a group of educators from across a spectrum, you know, in the Commonwealth. And one of the gentlemen in the meeting said, preparing for a school shooter does nothing to prevent a school shooter. And that is a very succinct way to look at this problem. We want to add legislation and policy so that people are looking at the problem before there's someone on the school grounds. You know, where is that person getting their firearm? In most of these cases, it's at home. You know, we put forth in the Virginia General Assembly this year legislation that would raise the age limit to purchase certain types of weapons. We put forth legislation that would increase the child access prevention laws so that there was more teeth in them as to who could what the circumstances are surrounding access to firearms in the home, and what the penalties are. And we also had an extreme risk protective order, which would put situations where a person is in crisis and actually remove the firearms for the home. So there's a lot of things you can do with regard to access. And my point in saying let's prevent a shooter versus preparing for one is exactly that. It's all about access to firearms.
But if I was against your thoughts, and I'll state out ahead of time, and it shouldn't be a surprise to anyone who's listened to this program on this radio station, a previous radio station for the 20 years I've been doing it, that I'm on your side of things. Mm-hmm. But if I was on the other side, I would say, well, we continue to have shootings in schools, and we haven't had guns in schools yet, so let's try it the other way. Let's try this law and see what happens and see if we stop having shootings in schools.
Well, I think that's, you know, number one, it's the wrong attitude. We have law enforcement in schools already. We have school resource officers. We have security guidelines. We have, you know, systems in place and personnel in place and assessments in place, threat assessment teams and other things. What is happening is we're not addressing access to firearms outside the school. Who has them? Who can carry them? Where can they come from? Is there an age limit? Is there restrictions on where and when and how you can buy them? We're not doing those things, you know, outside the school setting that allows a variety of people who are oftentimes prohibited, oftentimes at risk, or oftentimes dangerous to have access to firearms. We're not doing those things outside the school setting. And there are many, many of these school shootings where school resource officers are present, law enforcement are perhaps are present. They have security measures in place. It still doesn't always stop that shooter. There's, you know, you want to stop the person before they get the gun. That's the most effective and preventative measure. The state of Maryland is reporting that they've passed an extreme risk protective order law. That law allows them to go in and remove firearms from person deemed by a judge to be at risk of harm to self or others. And they have reported, you know, that four of these situations, when they investigated, were a credible risk of a school shooter. And they have been able to disarm that person. Guess what? That's a preventative measure. That person no longer has access to firearms, number one. And number two, that person is likely getting the help he or she may need for whatever crisis they're in.
Our guest today is Lori Haas. She's the Virginia State Director at the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, as well as the Education Fund to Stop Gun Violence. That bill you were talking about in Maryland, that law in Maryland, similar to the bill put forth at the Virginia legislature, is that one I'm looking at, House Bill 1957, a locked firearm for 14 to 18-year-olds in need of child care? And again, I'm throwing out all kinds of numbers here.
I shouldn't expect
people to remember, because when I looked at your page that you sent me the link to, there were dozens of them,
of
so
bills.
That's not fair. But is that what we're talking about? Is talking about
what's the bill number again that you're thinking about?
Is 1957. But are we talking about taking a for someone of an age who's having a problem? Are we talking about taking? And I shouldn't throw it out as a specific bill. Let me try and understand this bill being, or any bill being put forth, a little better. We're talking about a teenager underage who's having emotional and mental problems, a little, who's a judge, assuming with help, determines that this teenager is having emotional and mental problems during a time. Mm-hmm. So the police or government would go in and say,
no,
lock these guns up, take these guns away until this person is determined to be better off?
Under this bill, it's House Bill 1957. Delegate David Toscano from this very area was the patron on the bill. It's a very good bill. The bill basically and essentially said that if a child is in the system, they're getting services already, and they have been identified to be in need of services, that the judge in this case can require the parents to lock up any firearms in the home. Again, it's about access. If a child is suffering, whether it's behavioral, whether it's social or emotional, for whatever reasons that child may be in need of services and is in the system, that the judge in these cases can require the parent to lock up the firearms.
So that's one step further ahead than the one in Maryland.
No, the one in Maryland is different. So different bills address different situations. Delegate Toscano's bill was very narrowly focused. It was very narrowly focused on children who are receiving services. They've already been identified. The bill in Maryland, for which Virginia had one also, is called an extreme risk protection order. Much like we have protective orders for family members in domestic violence situations, oftentimes a woman, not always, she can go in front of a judge and petition a judge and say, I'm scared. Here's credible evidence that I'm scared of my abuser. Here's the evidence. Here are the risk factors. I want and need a protective order to keep myself or my children or my family, whatever, separated and have this person not be able to talk to me, come in my home, or whatever the circumstances for the protective order are. So we've seen protective orders. They've been in existence for a number of years. Treatment providers in the domestic violence space often can help a victim access the judicial system and get these protective orders. An extreme risk protection order is very similar. Oftentimes, someone is in crisis for a variety of reasons. It may not actually be a diagnosis of a mental illness. It may be anger. It may be frustration. They may be going through a divorce. They may be abusing alcohol. They may be abusing drugs. Many of those criteria do not qualify for a mental illness diagnosis. They just aren't mental illness. They're other things. They're anger. They're crisis. They're, you know, other emotional situations. But family members can recognize when a family member is having a difficult time, may be spiraling, may not be in control, may not be capable of making good decisions. Those family members can say, whoa, I'm really worried. I'm really worried. Go to a law enforcement officer or a Commonwealth's attorney, have the case go in front of a judge. The judge looks at and petition the judge. It's an actual petition process. It's a judicial process. And get an order from a judge to say, you know what? Let's take a time out. Let's remove your firearm during this time of crisis to protect you and protect others. Let's get you the help you need. And then once you are whole or the duration of the petition has expired, you know, once circumstances change, you can get your firearm back.
How successful were you, your organization, during this most recent General Assembly?
We could not get any of the good bills passed. You know, the Virginia Senate Courts of Justice killed all of our good bills. In the House side, the House Militia, Police, and Public Safety Committee killed all our bills. So, you know, we wanted very, very common sense policies that the majority of Virginians support. And we know that these policies work. Other states that have them have reduced rates of gun deaths, reduced rates of gun injuries. And, you know, we want to do more to save the lives of citizens across the Commonwealth in a lot of situations.
Our guest today again is Lori Haas. She's the state director for the Education Fund to Stop Gun Violence and the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Be right back to talk a little bit more about the General Assembly and why these good bills might not be getting passed. All right, back in action here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, talking about gun control and gun violence with our guest today, Lori Haas. She's with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. That's just one of two jobs she's got going on. The other is education about gun violence with the Education Fund to do so. Driving up from Richmond with us today. Ms. Haas, one of the things going on in the General Assembly and the legislature and trying to get these good bills passed is they all have to go through committee to start with. And with your committee being headed or the majority being Republican, it's difficult to get it through because you make it state that Republicans are pro-guns. So how do you make that happen?
You know, we have tried for a long time to get legislators from both sides of the aisle, and we've had success on one side of the aisle, not so much on the other, to understand that regulating access to firearms does not prohibit law-abiding citizens from purchasing firearms or owning firearms. We're trying to regulate, you know, access to firearms for people at risk of committing harm. Gun owners across the board, you know, in many situations, my husband included, understand that owning a firearm, you know, does not necessarily, it's not mutually exclusive to regulate how you get it, when you get it, where you carry it, and, you know, who has access. So gun owners, the majority of them are not opposed to regulating firearms and access in an effort to save lives. You know, the NRA is. The National Rifle Association does not represent gun owners. They represent manufacturers. Their goal is to sell more guns and make more money. And that by doing that, they keep the manufacturers happy. They keep their, you know, money flowing into their coffers. And that's their goal. They have a reputation of having, you know, this outsized influence on legislators. And for some, they do. For some, that influence is overstated and, you know, doesn't make sense to me. I don't think that the voters in many of these places and spaces are opposed to gun regulations. I think the majority of people want them.
I found a Richmond Times Dispatch opinion piece that you had written about Republicans, where you said that the NRA endorsed candidates lost three congressional seats to leaders who had gun violence prevention.
Yes. We've seen it at the polls in Virginia for a number of years now. In 2013, all three statewide candidates, then Terry McAuliffe, Ralph Northam, and Mark Herring, ran on guns and won on guns. They ran loudly. They did not run away from the issue. They did op-eds, they did ads, they did this. That was back in 2013, 6 years ago. We've seen it continue in that vein. In 2017, Ralph Northam, who was very devoted to this issue, he cares about all communities suffering from gun violence and has put forth a package in this General Assembly session that was very wide-ranging and would contribute to reducing gun violence. He ran in 2017, and he ran loudly and boldly on gun violence prevention and saving lives and doing more to impact what is happening in communities that see too much gun violence. He won by almost 10 points. This issue didn't harm him at all. It helped him. So I don't, you know, Republicans do take this stance, reject regulations, reject legislation, reject policy at their own peril. I think we're going to see that shift, the voting shift, as much in 2019 in November across the Commonwealth in these Senate races and these House races. I think you can no longer oppose safety and gun safety and saving lives and expect to win in Virginia. We're just seeing it, you know, across the board.
Well, you don't just read these numbers, these stories in in articles written by the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. You read them in somewhat intermediate, middle articles about how the majority of Americans would rather see background checks and waits for gun sales and things like that. Yet that doesn't seem to be what the Republican candidate is voting for.
You know, I don't understand it. I really genuinely can't grasp why any person would choose convenience. I don't want to go through a background check. I want to be able to, you know, buy a firearm at a gun show. I don't want to go through a background check. I want to be able to buy a firearm on the internet. Internet sales are just, you know, off the charts. And you don't know that person. You don't know whether they are or are not prohibited. The only way to find out is to do a background check. So, you know, to ignore the gun violence that is happening in front of our very eyes. 32 children ages 0 to 17, that's an average, die from firearm violence in Virginia every year. And they're doing nothing about that, not raising the age, not increasing the penalties for child access. It's just immoral, in my opinion. We've seen homicide rates rising in Virginia, gun homicide rates rising in Virginia. We've seen suicides rates going up. The suicide rate by firearm has gone up 21% between 2007 and 2016. The homicide rate in the last, since 2012, the firearm homicide rate in the Commonwealth of Virginia since 2012 has gone up 59%. This is access to firearms by people who shouldn't have them, and they're doing harm to self and others. And we've got to do something about both of those problems. And to have the Republicans continue to ignore this, and defeat these bills in committee and then again on the floor occasionally, it's just atrocious. It just makes no sense. And, you know, I think they're going to suffer at the polls and at in the ballot boxes as they have for a number of cycles now.
Does it fall to the basic line of Second Amendment, or does it fall to the financial contributions of NRA-backed
So the NRA doesn't donate as much money to individual candidates as some might think, although there's a number of candidates who get an immense number of donations from them, you know, especially at the federal level. There's a lot, you know, but the NRA does spend money, you know, running ads and, you know, promoting their point of view and just suggesting that any regulation is bad. That it's just a black and white for them. They don't want any regulations. You know, they're not concerned about child access. They're not concerned about, you know, prohibited people, you know, people with felony convictions getting access to firearms. They're just not concerned. They're concerned about selling guns. That's the NRA. That's who they are. They want to sell more guns. The NRA has an article out just recently in one of their printed literatures. You can get it, find it online. I think it's The Rifleman. I'm not sure exactly the name of the the publication, but they have a picture.
Oh, I know where
Speaker Pelosi.
I saw where you're going with
this. Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords standing to her right, and the name of the article is Target Practice.
Yeah, I saw
now,
that.
Now you know there. Their practices, their messaging, their spokespeople, their refusal to acknowledge the problem that gun violence, the public health problem, I find it deplorable, confusing, immoral, you know, wrong on so many levels. You know, they're toxic. They're not to be. I would be concerned for anybody who wants to have the NRA as a funder, as a supporter, as a friend, you know, as a colleague. There's a lot of investigation at the federal level on when, how, if, and what they're doing in cooperation with Russia. There's so much wrong with the NRA. I can't even begin to tell you.
Right. Target practice. I'm sure for some people it's funny or unintended.
It's in print. They intended it. It's in print.
Right. But if they were asked, they would say, oh, no, that's not what we meant. Or, oh, and for others it would be, oh, that's funny. But obviously that was, it's not.
Well, the subheading is.
It's neither.
The subheading is this, and think about if you change some of the words here, you know, and substitute, reversed them. Congressional Democrats target gun owners for persecution with extreme firearms transfer ban. I mean, are they suggesting that their members target Democrats for persecution? I mean, this is. It's just encouraging violence on some level. It's not, you know, it's amoral in the political discourse, you know. We're trying to save lives. You know, we're not trying to encourage violence. We're not trying to encourage use your firearms in every case. I mean, there was a candidate a number of years ago in Virginia who said, you know, if the ballot box doesn't work, use the bullet box. I mean, she said those words out loud.
If we could start with one new law, where would we start? Would you raise the age? Would you go with a background check? Would you go with a 5-day sale delay?
You know, it depends upon the goal of the policy or the goal of the legislation. You know, universal background checks is clearly what's moving at the congressional level right now. H.R. 8 is coming up for a vote this week on the House of Representatives on the floor. The reason we talk about background checks, and some people, you know, have a hard time, like, what is background checks going to do? Well, guess what? We have some prohibitions right now. If you're a convicted felon, you cannot buy a firearm. But guess what? You can go anywhere you want right now and buy a firearm without a background check. We're not enforcing that law because we don't have a means to do a background check on every sale. We need universal background checks. Universal background checks are the structure, the foundation, the base upon which the other prohibitions can and do work. You can have a prohibition, but if somebody can maneuver around that prohibition by going online, by going to a gun show, and by going to a street corner. Right now, you and I can walk outside, walk up here to, I guess it's Route 29, I don't know the name of the road.
Yes.
We can stand on the street corner, you and I can sell you a firearm in plain view, and there is absolutely nothing the local law enforcement can do about it. There's nothing illegal about that. I can sell any firearm I want to anybody I want.
33 minutes after the hour with our guest today, Lori Haas. She's the Virginia State Director for the Education Fund, and she's educating me on how to stop gun violence. Also with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence as we talk about guns and legislature, other issues. Also, it's still in discussion, correct, about concealed weapons and the rules in some states being transferred to other states. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's called reciprocity. So if you have a concealed carry permit in one state, then you're allowed to conceal carry in another state. So you have reciprocity. There are other types of licensing scenarios where you ask for or get reciprocity if you meet certain standards. I'm thinking of like a commercial driver's license or a license to practice law. You have to get a license in different states, and which states recognize different things. In Virginia, we have concealed handgun permits. The concealed permit only allows the person to carry a handgun concealed, not other weapons. To get a permit in Virginia is basically, from my perspective and from many others, you know, almost a joke. You can go online right now while you're listening to this show, find a concealed carry permit training website, answer 20 questions, and at the end of that 20-question test, get a certificate, and you've passed the concealed carry training. 20 questions online. You can then take that certificate to your local judge. The judge must issue the permit if you meet certain criteria on a checklist on an application that the person fills out. And you get your concealed handgun permit in Virginia. There is no hands-on training. There is no fingerprinting. The process is very, very porous and doesn't lend itself to any confidence on my part that a person with a concealed handgun permit is capable in a way that you would expect a person carrying a firearm in public to have that capability.
You mean like my incredibly poor eyesight?
Yes. Your blind grandmother can get a concealed handgun permit in the Commonwealth of Virginia. There's nothing that would prohibit a person in that situation from getting one. Yet, if you think about it, we require law enforcement to undergo hundreds of hours to be issued a service weapon and carry in public. Hundreds of hours. There's retention. Somebody going to steal that firearm off your body, and how are you going to do that? There's judgment. You know, can you judge the scenario around you? Are you capable of recognizing peripheral movement? Is a dog, as a child, is a this happening? There's accuracy. You know, you've got to train your eyesight. You've got to train your hands. It's muscle memory. There's so much, and I'm not even describing enough of the training and the broad range of training that our law enforcement
and
undergo.
Why are these getting blowback? Why isn't our law again, you know, making it more difficult?
Permit holders want to be able to carry their firearm everywhere and anywhere they go because it's convenient for them, because they want to be able to have that firearm on their person.
Well, it's convenient for me to park in my neighbor's yard, but that always isn't allowed either.
Yes. They, you know, permit holders will say that they're the most law-abiding citizens, they're the most upstanding citizens, that somehow they're going to save the day, somehow they're going to be in the right place at the right time, that their personal security requires them to have a firearm on their person at all times. We just don't see it. The data just does not support that. And again, you know, I have some confidence in the abilities of law enforcement to safely use a firearm. They undergo all that training. But there is even data out there. In an active shooter situation, law enforcement only hit their target, you know, somewhere in a range of like 16 to 24% of the time. With all that training, how often and how accurate are law enforcement? You think someone with no training, you know, who's never been in a simulator to have be able to react quick, to have the judgment, to, is there a kid or a dog or a violent felon coming over my right shoulder? You know what I mean? You know, they don't undergo any training. We've seen it time and again. So it's not the answer, you know, to threats. And we've seen permit holders, you know, in mass shootings not able to contribute. They were too scared. There were, you know, situations where they couldn't have time to react. And frankly, they didn't want law enforcement shooting them. It's just a fantasy. Doesn't work.
We're going to take our next break. We're going to come right back. Lori Haas, she's driven up from Richmond, where she's the Virginia State Director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Hang tight. There's still a lot more interesting things to talk about. All right, we're back with Lori Haas. Lori, I want to talk about some of the legislative issues that are still out there. We skimmed over some of them. Some of the things that I've got down here, there's the child access prevention, the extreme risk protection order, raising the age, reporting lost and stolen firearms. Let's start with disarming domestic abusers. One of the things that I found was that women are more likely to be murdered by a partner than by anyone else when murdered. And the chance of being murdered by an abusive partner increases 5 times when there's a gun in the home. Now, you mentioned taking the gun away when they report.
You know, we strongly support evidence-based legislation and policy. A history of violence is the single biggest predictor of future violence. We know that persons who are convicted of domestic violence misdemeanors, these are persons who have committed a crime, been in front of a judge, and have a conviction. They've committed domestic violence, and they have a misdemeanor conviction. They're not prohibited from purchasing, possessing, or transporting firearms. We feel strongly that by virtue of that conviction, they should be prohibited. We put in legislation that would prohibit them for like a 5-year period, i.e., you've committed domestic violence, you've gotten a conviction, let's prohibit you for 5 years. You can't purchase, possess, or transport a firearm. Let's disarm this domestic abuser. After 5 years, if you have no other convictions, maybe you've gotten some treatment, maybe you've turned your life around, maybe things are... you're moving in the right direction. We believe in second chances. After 5 years, yeah, get your firearm back if you haven't committed crimes in that duration. But again, a history of violence is the single biggest predictor of future violence, and we're allowing those very persons to be armed. And we've seen it time and time again, as you mentioned, you know, situations, domestic violence situations with a firearm present are much more lethal than when a firearm is not present.
So I'm assuming that these sorts of bills are being submitted in the General Assembly.
Yes.
And who's knocking these down?
Frankly, Republicans on the Senate Courts of Justice Committee, that's where the firearms bills go, and they get killed there.
What is their reasoning behind this? Because I see
I'm somewhat smirking because I cannot understand, and I can't really grasp what their reasoning is. You have a person who's been convicted of violence, and they don't want to prohibit that person from owning a firearm. I don't understand it. There is no reason behind it.
Well, sometimes
we just got to change their seats.
Sometimes you'll get an explanation that says, you know, oh, my neighbor was a good guy and he had a bad accident. And so I'm using that as my explanation, and I can't base it on you know, one incorrect judgment.
You know, it's not one incorrect judgment. You're in front of a judge. You're in a court of law. It takes a lot to get these prosecutions. A lot of them are, you know, reduced or dismissed or pled out or all sorts of stuff. These are people with convictions, and it's not a misnomer. It wasn't a one-time thing.
Are all the Democrats voting for it?
Yeah. Yes, they are.
I mean, is it 12 to 10? 12 Republicans?
Well, the
10
on
Democrats,
the Senate Courts of Justice Committee is made up of 15 sitting state senators. 9 are Republicans, 6 are Democrats, and the bills fail 9-6 almost every time.
You have
the same in the House Militia, Police, and Public Safety. They're killed, you know, on party line votes all the time. You'll occasionally see one person, you know, cross the line, you know, like on a floor vote, something, you know, may happen. But again, Republicans, you know, in these gerrymandered districts, you know, have control of the House, have control of the Senate, and they're killing these bills year in and year out. And they did it again in 2019. We have to just vote them out in November. This issue.
Well, that was done a lot 2 years ago.
In 17.
A year and multiple months ago.
Yeah, 2017 we saw it. And I think we're going to see it again.
We were one ping pong ball away from turning the tide. And you could have been in charge of
It could have been in a different position. You know, there are a lot of legislators who understand that this issue is, you know, morally sound just on that basis, but it's politically sound. It is the political high ground. You know, this will win you votes. Again, I have to, you know, talk about Governor Ralph Northam. He won in 2017 by almost 10 points. And I would say that his stance on this issue was a big part of that. And the polls suggest that I'm right. It's, you know, Virginians support this across the board. Republicans, Democrats, independents, libertarians, apolitical, political, you know, men, women, you know, people from all backgrounds and all socioeconomic backgrounds. And, you know, it's time. When you have a public health problem of this magnitude, you have solutions and you're not implementing those solutions. Something's wrong.
About the child access prevention issues, suicides and toys.
You know, suicides for so many families who have suffered the death of by suicide of a loved one, there's all this second guessing, there's all this regret. We know that firearms are particularly lethal, you know, as a means of suicides. We just have to do more to prohibit access to firearms by persons at risk. There's a recent report out, and I have it in front of me. I'm looking at it. For suicide attempts by gun, 85% result in death. For suicide attempts by all other means, 5% result in death. And the recidivism rate is very, very low. Those persons who attempt suicide and fail, their loved ones surround them. Services surround them, the community surrounds them, and they get the help they need, and they become healthy and whole and, you know, go on to, generally speaking, leading productive lives. And that moment in time where they survived is just that. It's a moment in time where they were in such dire pain and in such crisis that they cried out for help the only way they could, and it was impulsive, and they attempted suicide. For those persons who use a firearm in that impulsive moment, in that single moment in time, in 85% of the cases, they're no longer with us. They don't have this chance and the opportunity to get the support, to get the treatment, to get the services they need. So our organization feels very, very strongly about policies that prevent access by persons at risk. Whether those, you know, whatever those crises are. And that also transcends to children. They're impulsive. They don't understand what a firearm is. They don't understand lethality. Developmentally, you know, a 2-year-old doesn't have a clue what they're doing. Even an 8-year-old, even a 12-year-old sometimes, you know, they just can't developmentally understand the finality of death. It just isn't available to them. And yet we don't have child access laws, which is the one you asked about. And we see teen suicide rates increasing with firearms. We see toddlers killing toddlers. We see toddlers injuring parents. I mean, there's just too much access to firearms in too many situations. And that's what our organization is all about. We want to minimize access to firearms by persons who either aren't old enough, aren't capable enough, are in a risk situation, or evidence shows they're dangerous. We want to do more about preventing access in an effort to save lives. You know, one of our taglines is it's about saving lives. It's not about the gun owner. It's about saving lives.
Again, our guest today is Lori Haas. She is the Virginia State Director for the Education Fund to Stop Gun Violence, as well as the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. She's here with us today from Richmond, 50 minutes after the hour. Our hour is speeding by. You know, I was just doing things in preparation for today, and you can certainly go further back, but you go back to Columbine. So after the last 20 years, our society has witnessed large and small gun shootings at high schools, Columbine and Stoneman Douglas are 20 years apart. Colleges, at least one elementary school. Churches, workplaces, grocery stores, bars, movie theaters, and concerts. And I'm curious, what changes have been made other than some people purchasing more guns out of concern that their guns were going to be taken away?
You know, we've seen a great amount of movement on legislation at the state level. You know, we haven't seen it. You know, Congress has been broken for a number of years. They just can't get anything done when these two parties are so far apart. And, you know, during the Obama years when Republicans were in control of the House and Senate and he was in the White House and you couldn't get anything done, nothing, not on our issue, not on any other issue. So, you know, we've seen just such a stalemate at the federal level over the years that I've been doing this work, but not at the state level. You know, at the state level, we have, you know, almost 2/3 of the state have universal background checks now. Since the Stoneman Douglas shooting, we have passed extreme risk protection order laws in 8 states, I believe. Another 20 states have put this legislation forward. We're moving the ball. Colorado just got it out of committee last week. A newly elected delegate, Tom Sullivan, whose son was killed in the Aurora Theater movie shooting, was the principal co-sponsor behind that bill and was moving that bill. We have seen the movement grow leaps and bounds at the local level, at the state level, at the national level. We're moving the issue politically. We see candidates getting elected time and time and time again at the local, state, and federal level. The movement is broad. We are doing more as a movement to recognize the real gun violence issue, that in addition to the mass shootings that the media shines the spotlight on, what we care about and what we're trying to work on and what many people understand is it's, you know, the average of 100 people per day in the United States that are shot and killed, and the average of, you know, hundreds more that are shot and wounded every month in this country. So we want to do something about all types of gun violence, particularly in communities that suffer disproportionate amounts of gun violence. African American males of a certain age group, are the homicide rate is off the charts. We have got to do something about that. It's one of the reasons we put forth, and it was one of the governor's bills, to require the reporting of lost and stolen. We've got to dry up it's not the black market, it's the unregulated market. You can buy 12 firearms, you know, legally or wherever, from a neighbor, from a friend, from a gun show, from a federally licensed dealers, and then you can go sit on the street corner, you know, wherever you want and sell those firearms. And it's unregulated. It's pouring too many firearms into places and spaces that see disproportionate amounts of firearms. You know, places like Richmond and places like Newport News and other communities that have suffered egregiously in the socioeconomic setbacks unfairly. And they have this unregulated firearms just flowing into their communities. We've got to stop that. We've got to do something about it.
Has the incident at the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High last February 14th, has that brought about the teenage?
Yes. Yeah.
Has that made them activists?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We've seen it. You know, we've seen it across the board with March for Our Lives. And they're working hard to raise awareness, shine the spotlight on the problems in other spaces and places, not just school shootings, you know, trying to shine the spotlight on, you know, the violence that we see across the board. Again, these mass shootings get the media attention, but we take that attention, hopefully, in our organization and others, to shine the spotlight on all forms of gun violence.
But is that getting things done and getting hearing
yes.
that
oh,
might
yes.
not have otherwise been done without them?
Yeah, we had only been able to move the extreme risk protection order legislation in 5 states. We've moved it in 8 or 9 since February. That's unheard of. That's unheard of, moving legislation that quickly and across the board. And we're working on, you know, other measures in other states.
Would you be doing this without what happened at Virginia Tech?
I don't know. I can't honestly answer that, you know.
There's just 3 minutes left. Will you tell your story for those who are listening?
Yes, yes. My daughter was 19 in 2007 when the shooting happened. She was in French class. And, you know, as everybody knows, it was just a tragedy of, you know, unfathomable proportions. And at the time, the largest mass shooting, you know, in the country. 32 students were shot and killed. They weren't lost. They were shot and killed. Another 17 were shot and injured and survived. And, you know, another, I don't know, 8 or so were shot jumping out a window. Can you imagine being in a window 2 stories up and looking behind you and saying, I can get shot or I can get hurt? Which way am I going? But it was a tragedy of just epic proportions. My daughter survived and is whole and healthy now. I'm you know, so glad of that. All the injured students went back and got their degrees. It's, you know, shook me to my core. But in the immediate aftermath, my good friend Andy Goddard, whose son Colin was shot and injured, you know, he started me down this path. You know, why did this happen? How did he get the firearm? Where were the laws? Why was this person able to access this firearm? So really pushed me, you know, and helped me and started me down this path. And I've been on it ever since. I'm working on 10 years with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence and the Educational Fund to Stop Gun Violence. They're good organizations. They support my work. They support a lot of work across the country. They've been around for a long, long time, longer than all the other national groups. I will put a plug out there. We're a nonprofit. If you want to support us, please do. Lots of ways to support us. But we're doing, you know, it's hard work. But I'm committed. I'm not going away. I'm blessed in a way to be able to do, you know, a job that I'm so passionate about and so committed to. I met families across the United States, you know, in the immediate aftermath, you know, the families affected by that tragedy, but I've met dozens and dozens more. I got an email from Fred Gutenberg, you know, this morning, and, you know, we're talking, and I talked to survivors across the Commonwealth and across the country. So it's hard work, but it's necessary work, and I'm committed to it. And I think most Virginians are extremely supportive, and I'm grateful every day for the support that I get from so many people.
And I haven't given out the websites, so do that quickly just before we finish up.
www.csgv.org, Coalition Stop Gun Violence, our letters, and www.efsgv.org, so our call letters.
And we'll make sure to put those in the podcast. Thanks again so much for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Lori Haas, she is the Virginia State Director for the Education Fund to Stop Gun Violence and the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. And you can certainly come back anytime because there's so much material we didn't get to. All right. We'll have the Charlottesville tomorrow on next Sunday. Thanks, everybody.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SevillePodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of The Wake-Up Call, only on 94.7 WPVC.